social network, mypera.net.
We take away the fear using logic and scientific protocol with integrity and dedication to clients. We are devoted to furthering the field, promoting up-to-date research, and setting higher standards. We educate, eliminating misinformation and fraud, empowering clients and fellow researchers. We are the Ghost Society.
Welcome once again to the Ghost Society's podcast. I am your host, Jeremy Ryder. Along with me is my hostess with the Moses, Carolyn Doherty.
Hello.
Matt, we're hoping you're feeling better by this point and you're not blistered like a lobster. So, bad tanning. Bad.
Bad.
Yeah. So, today's show is about parapsychology and paranormal investigating. And we're going to have a number of topics about this. Carolyn did a ton of research on this and lost brain cells in the process, much to our chagrin. But anyways, go ahead.
Not that that's an uncommon experience with me, but before we go into parapsychology, though, I would like to touch on a movement that was kind of related because it kind of sprouted up at the same time, and that's spiritualism.
Yeah.
Some people call it a religion. Some people call it a movement. I mean, that's kind of a, you know, based on your opinion. But spiritualism developed and reached its peak growth in membership from the 1840s to the 1820s. By 1897, it was said to have more than 8 million followers in the United States and Europe. And most of these people came from middle and upper classes, and there's a lot of speculation of why that could be. It flourished for half a century without having any formal organization or text or whatever that you would attribute to a religion. But it did have, it attained its cohesion through periodicals, tours by trance lecturers, camp meetings, and missionary activities of accomplished mediums. And again, I'm getting all of this from Wikipedia and other sources. Many prominent spiritualists were women. And this is kind of important. And at this time period, remember, women did not have the right to vote.
Nope.
Many of them couldn't own property. They didn't have a reliable means of getting their own substantial income. You know, so this would appeal, if you were a woman at this time and you could find a way to make a pretty good living, I could see the appeal.
That's right. They wanted to stick it to the man.
That's right.
Literally.
Anyway, I'm not going to go there. By the late 1880s, the credibility of the informal movement had weakened due to accusations of fraud being
perpetuated.
Thank you. By mediums and formal spiritualists organizations. So one of that we already talked about on an earlier show in 1888, one of the reasons for the decline is that the poster girls, the Fox sisters, actually came out publicly in front of an audience of 2,000 people and said, guess what, we made it up.
Nah, we got you.
And they even denounced spiritualism as a movement, called it a fraud.
The one called it a curse in America.
You know, so, again, now during the spiritualist movement, there was a lot of, quote, spirit photography that came in. Because remember,
yes,
photography was a new medium at the time.
Yes, it was.
Pardon the pun. But with photography came all sorts of new ways to make things.
Yes.
Yeah. Mumbler was a photographer, and what do we call the Mumbler effect today?
The mumbling?
No, double exposure.
Oh, double exposure, yes.
So he would actually, because with long exposure film, and all serious paranormal investigators know this by now, with the longer exposure, you can actually, you know, create an effect.
An after image.
Yeah, and after that looks like a ghost is standing there. And that's what he did. He would have famous photographs where he'd have a subject, you know, basically standing behind someone, they would move and the shadow would appear and it would look like a ghostly image.
Yep.
And there were other hoaxing things that they devised with mirrors, with glass, with all sorts of things that they did. One of the most frightening things they did was ectoplasm, and this was when the term was actually coined. Before this movement and before spirit photography, nobody ever said ghosts leave behind any goo or slime. This came as a device to kind of prove to people there was a ghostly present. And in reality, what people were doing, and this is disgusting, they would take cheesecloth and other gauzy material, they would put it in various body orifices, and during the seance, the medium would, let's just say, secrete it. And anyway, so how could we not smell that?
I don't know.
So going back to the whole fraud thing, and there's spiritualism, unfortunately, just has way too many connections and connotations with fraud. Harry Houdini, among many, many different scientists and doctors, as well as magicians such as Harry Houdini, they studied mediums, and they actually exposed a lot of them for the fraud they were. Harry Houdini had absolutely he found no evidence of any supernatural ability of anything that he ever investigated.
Well, to play devil's advocate with Harry Houdini there, at first he was a believer.
Right.
It was after
his
mother had passed. He was friends with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Doyle's wife is supposedly a medium also. And now, mind you, Harry's mom was Jewish. She basically had things in a very Catholic tone come out for Harry, his supposed messages from her mother. And this is when Harry Houdini started to debunk spiritualism and mediums.
Right.
But at one point he got so fervent in his debunking that even if he did come across something genuine, which we're not saying that he did, he would denounce it as fraud.
And that's because, there was an emotional component.
Exactly.
If somebody tricks you into think that you're talking to your dead mother, you're going to be pretty ticked off.
Exactly.
And which is why...
Yeah, his relationship with Conan Doyle was never the same after that.
I personally have an issue with some of the modern TV psychics that I have seen in person do these type of things, where one in particular, he's nothing more than a cold reader, in my opinion. And when he had misses, he deflected it back on the grieving family. Like, oh, you just didn't he's telling me you just didn't know the other side of the story. And those poor grieving people look like they've been kicked in the stomach.
Yep.
So anyway, it continues on to today. But because of the rise of spiritualism and other interests in the paranormal, there is also a rise in educated people, scholars and doctors and scientists from various fields who were interested in studying what's going on. So, generally, when we talk about parapsychologists today, unfortunately, the term has been kind of morphed into something else. It's been...
it's almost like a catchphrase now.
Right. And a lot of people who call themselves parapsychologists today, unfortunately, a lot of them really don't have the credentials to back that up as far as what the original concept of parapsychology was. Generally, the valid parapsychologies, when these organizations were started, and the idea behind it was started, they had advanced degrees in sciences such as psychology, physics, or anthropology. It's also important to know, because, clear up till the 1980s in this country, quite a few organizations, or I shouldn't say organizations, universities around the country, Princeton, Duke, Stanford, or just to name a few, had parapsychology labs in them.
Right.
It's important for people to understand these people coming into their homes for to observe or investigate paranormal claims didn't charge the people. So people might say, well, where'd they get their money? When you work for a university, you get a grant. You get funded through the university, and that's how they got their equipment and they got the funds to go there. So there was no charging of clients. So people really, I think, sometimes get that mixed up.
Right. Well, as you're saying, the last accredited degree was awarded in the U.S. in the 1980s, and the general scope of research went into telepathy, precognition, clairvoyance, psychokinesis, near-death experience, reincarnation, and apparitional experiences. There was no cryptos or UFOs involved at that time.
Yeah, that's one thing I do want to make sure people understand. Parapsychology has nothing to do with, they have no affiliation with cryptozoology or ufology at all. It's more, you could say it's more of a psychic type field.
Right.
The phrase was actually first coined by a philosopher named Max Dossier, and I hope I got it right, around 1889. And this was later adopted by J.B. Rhine of the Rhine Institute that most of us have heard of, to replace the term psychical research. So some of the, and I'm not going to go into the U.K. The U.K. also had a lot of organizations spring up around the same time. And to this day, they actually do have accredited degrees in the U.K. in parapsychology. So I know a lot of paranormal researchers kind of say, well, there's absolutely no certification. Well, in the U.K. there is, so that people need to be aware of. So before you go out and call people liars and stuff, do homework first.
Always a good idea.
Yeah. And actually, the first one was in the U.K. It was founded in 1882, and that's the Society for Psychical Research. And their early membership, of course, had philosophers and scholars and scientists. And again, you already addressed the scope.
Yeah, they're going into telepathy, hypnotism, apparitions, haunts and physical aspects of spiritualism, like materialism.
Yeah.
And materialism came along with the ectoplasm. There was also materialism to where a horn would fly around the room and blast notes and stuff like this.
Or things would appear, like they would ask for, and like coins would just suddenly appear on the table.
Coins, watches, pocket watches was popular also, so.
And again, this came about the same time that spiritualism was starting to wane and more scientists were starting to try and understand what was going on, not only with the claims, but with what mediums, so-called mediums, were doing.
Right.
So that's what prompted this. In America, the American Society for Psychical Research, which, by the way, is still in existence, was founded in New York City in 1885. It was largely supported by the psychologist William James, which, as most people who studied psychology in college, you'll recognize, he was a contemporary of Carl Jung. And Carl Jung, just real briefly, came up with the idea of synchronicity, which is we take random events and we try to give some meaning to it.
See the pattern.
Yeah. And a lot of people find that it seems to have a supernatural significance to it. For example, if I'm thinking of a friend that recently passed away, which did happen to me, and I'm thinking of her and thinking of her and thinking of her, and suddenly a song comes on from the 80s that we used to kind of listen to and laugh about by a band, I might be thinking, well, gee, maybe there's a connection there. And that's an example of synchronicity. Now, some lab coats might say, but synchronicity has nothing to do with the supernatural. The truth is, Carl Jung was interested in the paranormal. He believed in the paranormal, and this is what led him to certain things. Even after he wrote this groundbreaking paper on synchronicity and came up with this theory, there's evidence from letters and other papers that he still had that little bit of, well, maybe there's something else there. So
right.
He didn't explain it all away, in other words. So, going on to other universities. In 1911, Stanford, which I think is a good school, thank you very much, became the first academic institution in the U.S. to study ESP and psychokinesis in a lab setting. Headed by psychologist John Edgar Hoover. And then in 1930, which was, you know, obviously much later, Duke University started studies of ESP and psychokinesis, PK, in the lab under psychologist William McDowell, with also other psychologists Carl Ehner and Joseph Rhein and Louisa Rhein, which we know later...
The Rhein Institute.
Yeah.
In 1957, the Psychological Association was founded in North Carolina, proposed by J.B. Rhein. They aim to advance parapsychology as a science and to integrate findings with other branches of science. And in 1969, under anthropologist Margaret Mead, the PA affiliated with the American Association for Advancement of Science.
And that's still current. There were a lot of, I guess, not so nice, I don't know if they're nice or not, but kind of snarky scientists who wanted them to dissolve this. They felt, and they still do, feel that parapsychology is a pseudoscience and has absolutely no place in this Association for Advancement of Science. However, enough fight has been won that they still are affiliated with it. And I think it is important that, you know, the aim was to integrate it with other findings of other branches. So, for example, if you just want to say, hey, there's psychic behavior or you know, like in my case, you know, I saw a shoe flying off one time. Is that an example of psychokinesis? Okay. Who can study that? Who has the degrees, the training, the lab work that can make sense of that data? And yeah, I think someone in physics would be a great candidate. And I think that's why when people kind of poo-poo parapsychology, it's really important to know these guys and women do have relevant knowledge that can be applied.
Right. Yeah, so I mean, instead of just putting one label on it, these people have a further background. Mm-hmm. Like you said, in anthropology and physics and theoretical science and thermodynamics and everything like this.
Right, and we talked about the Amityville case earlier, and there was a psychic who worked, who was one of the first ones to say there's nothing here. And that's why I was talking, this psychic is not like the mind reader type, not the kind that does cold readings. These are the kind that, under laboratory settings, did countless of different types of experiments. You know, we've all seen pictures of those cards with the wavy lines and the stars and whatnot. That's what we're talking about. They had control settings. They did collect the data in a scientific manner. Unfortunately, the problem is they can't always recreate the same experiment with the same outcome. And that's why mainstream science to this day has a problem with it. But again, in my opinion, that doesn't mean we throw it out.
No.
You know.
No, it just gives you a starting point to go from, and then you're supposed to move on from there.
Now, it's interesting to notice in the 1970s the scope expanded and other organizations were formed across the country. Parapsychological work was also conducted, I know, I can't talk at all, conducted at the Stanford, I never said I was a professional at this. Never, never, never.
This is true.
Conducted at Stanford's Research Institute. It expanded into altered states of consciousness. Now, at this time, this was the beginning of the New Age movement. The hippie dippies had been, you know, interested in Eastern culture and religions, and with that came, you know, meditation, levitation, you know, different altered states of consciousness. So they did bring that into the scope of things. Psychiatrist Ian Stevenson conducted research into reincarnation. I have my own thoughts on that. Psychologist Thelma Moss studied the Carillion photography, which we can also talk about at a later date. And UCLA's parapsychology lab was formed. Physicist Russell Trugg coined the term, quote, remote viewing. And we all can relate that to the governments. I believe it's the Project Stargate.
That was one of the projects they did. And that actually went past the time that they said it disbanded.
Right.
They said it disbanded in mid-80s. It actually went on into the mid-90s.
Covertly. Because officially they shut it down saying it was a failure, but yeah, after the fact we know it went on longer.
Yeah, a lot of the Cold War documents that have become declassified since has said that they actually had quite a bit of success with it.
Yeah, and some of those, if you read some of those, I mean, they had some pretty significant hits that they did use in military maneuvers, which makes you wonder.
Exactly.
And again, it just goes back to, if you just dismiss everything out of hand, you might be missing some potential evidence.
Right.
That can be applied to what we do.
Yeah, and to go along with your talking of how they started bringing in altered states and everything, this has actually become very helpful in the medical field. Mm-hmm. With sleep apnea and sleep labs and sleep studies to where they've helped people with sleep disorders.
Right. And understanding, for example, hypnagogic hallucinations, which we talk about quite a bit, this is part of how some of this was recognized.
Exactly.
So I mean, the criticism still does remain in mainstream scientists. Some of it is quite fair. I mean, there have been overt fraud in
yes.
some of the experiments, and some of them were just because they weren't overt fraud, but the controls weren't what you would call strict controls or strict...
Right. Wasn't as tidy as it could have been.
Right, so there's a lot of criticism. On the other side of that, people can say, well, this stuff isn't predictable, but unfortunately to satisfy science, you can't... Well, there has to be some sort of standard there.
Yeah, there has to be a little give and take there somewhere.
And in truth, the body of evidence right now, today, is kind of poor. As I mentioned before, there's no conclusive results. You know, but I have to say there's enough compelling evidence in some studies and whatnot that it is still gaining some attention from reliable, respectable scientists.
Right.
So one of the things of I do want to talk about is going back to this pseudoscience. The writers that, or the authors, I should say, of the science standards for the State of California Board of Education at this point still considers it a pseudoscience. So I know there are so-called parapsychology courses being offered in the State of California. I do believe, after reading this and other information, it is not part of an accredited State Board of Education approved program. So I do stand by, at this point in the United States, there's no accredited degree.
Right.
So.
Well, in regard to ghost hunting, you can't prove one unknown with another unknown. This applies to some are attempting to apply quantum physics to ghosts.
And psychics to ghosts.
Quantum physics, as it stands with our current technology, there's a lot of unprovens.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of theory out there. Even though quantum physics is recognized by mainstream science, there's still enough of the unknown, unproven territory that in and of itself it's a theoretical science or a pseudoscience.
Because at this point, we also don't have the instruments to measure it. We just
right.
don't have the technology and the know-how to measure some of these theories. And that can change. I mean, we've talked about recent cases where, for example, when we talk about the laws of physics and the imperial laws of physics and how they can't be broken, well, we know that's not true. I mean, recently CERN found something that does travel faster than the speed of light. You know, so it's still out there. It still needs to be approached, and to dismiss it again, I think is not doesn't serve anybody.
Right.
Now, this also goes back to some of the psychic work that has been done. Now, just because you put somebody in a sensory deprivation chamber and they are able to pick up on thoughts seemingly projected to them, specific images and again, this is all monitored and has been recorded. How they're picking this up, we don't know. There seems to be a correlation that something is going on that's paranormal. But how does that relate to Aunt Betty's ghost walking around in the attic? You know, it's a far cry. Even if we prove, there is a psychic connection there, or even if we can prove psychic kinesis happens, which does relate to me in ghost hunting in cases of when people report things flying around or people feeling punched or something, that can apply to that. But again, until it's proven...
Right.
And again, just because psychic ability exists, it doesn't necessarily mean dead people are walking around.
Exactly.
But, you know, again, people like Carl Sagan and others who, again, have advanced degrees and are recognized in different science fields say there are some claims which at least have some experimental support. And they do deserve further study. You know, some of that is what? The random generators that we talked about.
Right.
Recently, Cornell had a study that supported this. Other studies have shown that somehow it's a very slight chance, but people are able to affect these random generators slightly above chance. And it's repeatable. And it, you know, it's observable and repeatable. So, what's happening? They don't know. And again, that's a far cry from Aunt Betty's ghost walking around. But, you know, it does give some credence to...
Well, just them saying that we don't know means it's something other than normal, mm-hmm. which is the very definition of paranormal.
Right.
So.
Also, we discussed this earlier, but people under mild sensory deprivation have been able to apparently receive thoughts and images projected at them. Again, this has been recorded, it's been observed, and right now they don't have an explanation for that. But it is above chance of guessing. So what's going on there, we don't know. Reincarnation, now that opens a whole can of worms.
Yeah, it does.
Because then you're bringing religion into it. The reason I find it interesting is... We've talked about consciousness.
Yes.
And we've also talked about how energy may imprint on the environment. So perhaps people aren't truly experiencing reincarnation, but something else that can be interpreted as reincarnation. So maybe they are picking up on somebody else's experiences from a different life, but it doesn't mean they themselves experienced it. You know what I mean?
It's a very sticky wicket.
Yeah.
The discussion of reincarnation. Only because, you know, like you're saying, you're bringing people's beliefs into it.
Yeah.
You know, you can't really look at it with a detached eye because you have to put some spin of a belief onto it.
Right. And that's why maybe they shouldn't label it reincarnation.
Maybe they should label it as transported consciousness.
Yeah.
Or something
to that effect. But yeah. And again, going back to precognition, there was a recent Cornell study that showed, again, this is very, very tiny chances and tiny percentages, but it does show that there is some effect. And I'm trying to remember the guy's name. I have it somewhere. Anywho, it was recently at Cornell University, which again is accredited university, is no slouch. I mean,
no.
It's a well-respected university. It's a well-respected research university. So
yeah, not just for agriculture, but for a lot of
medical. You know, so that's why, again, a lot of people in this field, his name is Daryl Byrne, and he has actually published, human beings possess an innate, perhaps unconscious ability to foresee the future. Now, this doesn't mean your psychic friends network. I mean, this is just...
No Miss Cleo, no $9.99 a minute?
No.
Okay.
Although that would be cool because you could charge a lot of money. So it's not related to that kind. It again, it has to do with the random generating thing, but it you know, it's interesting enough that somehow people are affecting machines. I think that's interesting.
Yeah, definitely.
But a lot of people, going back to what I was going to say, is too many people in this field just dismiss it, and I think it needs to be re-examined with an open mind.
Well, if you're going to look at the data, you need to look at all the data.
Right.
You know, you can't just look at the segments that happen to fit your thought process.
Exactly. And to go along with what you were just saying, you know, Brian David Josephson is a physicist who won the Nobel Prize in Physics on his work on superconductivity. And this was back in 1973. But today he supports further study of parapsychology with the integration of other fields. You know, he feels that, as I was saying before, you can apply maybe biochemistry, physics, as I mentioned before, and other things to explain seemingly unexplainable events. So instead of these people dismissing stuff, you know, it would be awesome to me if we can explain a lot of experiences.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And it would also, what do? We try to alleviate people's fear. If I was sitting in my kitchen and I had, you know, we had one case where someone had something thrown at her, wouldn't it be nice to tell her with conclusive evidence, hey, this is what's going on, and back it up with scientific fact? That would make me feel a lot better than saying, well, we don't really know. It could be a ghost being pissed off and throwing stuff at you, which, you know, we wouldn't say that anyway, but, you know, there's always that seed in that person's mind, right?
Right, right, exactly. I mean, they're already freaked out enough that they called us in to begin with.
Right.
So.
An example of ongoing research that goes back from the days of when parapsychology first started up. I know you're familiar with this. A lot of people who are interested in paranormal or have heard of this guy. Duncan McDougall did the famous experiments, 21 grams, where he took scales. He kind of hung out at, I think it was a tuberculosis ward, and he hung out until people died. Just before they were about to die, he stuck them on a scale and tried to weigh them at the moment of death. The very first patient, patient one, there was a weight loss of 21 grams, and he concluded it to be the soul. Modern researchers looking back at, I think he had 5 or 6 in all before he got kicked out and he had to resort to dogs. Looking at the data, the experiment itself was flawed. Some of the controls was flawed. The instrument he used, the spring scale, which is the best that they had at the time. I mean, let's give him credit.
Right.
You know, has its flaws. So, but, you know, at the same time, it has enough interest to get people thinking that do have the, you know, brains or whatever. Hey, let's look into this. Let's try it today with today's technology. So,
personally, my soul weighs 200 pounds.
Okay. So,
just saying.
Mine is light and fluffy because it has wings. Okay. Professor at the Duke University School of Medicine, Dr. Jerry, I think his name is Nahum. Anyway, he has degrees from Stanford, Yale, in chemical engineering, thermodynamics, and information theory. Anyway, he would like to build a box that also measures electromagnetic fields.
That'd be a good idea.
He wants a contained box along with the scale that we're talking about. Now, he said if, you know, if we look at laws of physics, and again, I know laws are, you know, subject to change, there, if there is a weight loss with energy, because the mass changes. So if the mass changes, there has to be weight loss. So he thinks, in his theory, he said it's like a trillionth. You know, we could never measure it. you know, with basic equipment. It has to be highly sensitive scales. However, if you put it in and it correlates with some sort of electromagnetic field trying to leave that box, then you got something. Unfortunately, he doesn't have the funding yet. He hasn't gotten the funding yet. But, you know,
more volunteers, apparently.
But if you think about it, I mean, here's where I would like to see more of the field. I'd like to see people with his credentials and his background taking a serious look at this. And, you know, if he could apply it, that could answer a lot of questions.
It could. It could actually put a lot of people at ease, too.
Exactly. You know, so at the end of the day, how do you think this affects us as an average paranormal investigator? Again, you know, we can't use one unknown to prove another unknown. And we have to go in there understanding that.
Yeah. The best way I've ever seen it put is you got to keep an open mind, have your mind open, but not so open that your brain falls out of your head.
Right. You know, and I think, now, many parapsychologists use mediums and other subjective methods, and in some cases it might be good, it might someday explain some things. In others, not so much, because it's too subjective, and we talked about the Amityville case, when you're only getting information from a medium that says you're on an Indian burial ground, that turns out that's really not true at all.
Not even have the right tribe.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, then there's issues there. But the study of psychokinesis, you know, if that's proven, it can explain an awful lot of activity.
Yes, it can.
And it could alleviate a lot of fear, and maybe even give some solutions. For, you know, there's a big theory out there that parapsychologists like Dr. William Roll and others have come up with, is that poltergeist activity truly only is psychokinesis. It's nothing what they consider paranormal, because they say it's part of our brain and how our brain works. You know, if there's a way, they say it comes to being because of stress, especially
hormonal
around
change,
especially around adolescence. It has been documented in adults as well. There's a case by Dr. Broughton, who has talked about this, wherever this secretary went, I mean, spontaneous fires, you know, she finally lost her job, you know. And
but the fire department's looking for her.
Yeah. So, I mean, there is document cases that show some very interesting, what's going on here. But if you could find a way to treat that person, maybe, hey, you're doing something.
Invite her to every marshmallow roast.
Stop it.
Just saying.
So what do we do as the Ghost Society and as what we like to call ourselves logic-based or science-based paranormal investigators? We set out to debunk and find natural causes first, because we can't conclude, or at least we feel, we can't conclude anything is paranormal until we rule out all the other possibilities first. And that's why, you know, we don't want to dismiss the work of parapsychology, because again, as we talked about, maybe some of this can be explained with what they're studying.
Right. And we do a lot of experimentation also, you know, which is pretty much what the parapsychology field is about. You know, you do experiment after experiment, see what you get. So,
And again, I think it will gain more credibility the more that they bring in scientists from various fields, tighten up the controls and the standards of their research, and, you know, maybe instead of 10, 15 years down the road, instead of it being a pseudoscience, it may actually be a recognized science. And,
exactly.
And that would be something that I would welcome.
So what would your dream team be if this came about?
If I had a dream team to put together for a paranormal investigation, outside of ours, of course.
I was going to say, I better be included.
You know, outside of the Ghost Society. But in seriousness, I would want people who have degrees in, and not just degrees, but field experience, lab experience, in psychology, anatomy, and physiology with the relevant pathology that applies to it, meteorology, geology, physics, and then just basics in electronics. I mean, we use a lot of gadgetry, so it would be nice if somebody, you know,
knew how to work it. Yeah.
Or build some. Build,
right.
You know, like we talked to Wes Forsythe earlier, and he talked about, well, why aren't we finding ghosts? Maybe we're not using the right stuff. So it would be nice, people who are knowledgeable in electronics, maybe we can build stuff, you know, and maybe someday we'll hit the nail on the head. So going on, people with a degree in photography, videography, audio engineering, and then people who have experience in construction that recognize building materials, structural engineering, and, you know, your basic plumbing and wiring. I think this group of people with this, you know, school of knowledge, that's how we debunk. That's how we could explain all possible explanations first, rule those out, and then what you have left over, okay, what is this? And how do we study it?
Right. Well, I mean, it's like I've always said, you know, once you rule out all the natural explanations, whatever you're left with, you know, then you're just starting to scratch the surface at that point.
Right.
You know.
And it doesn't necessarily mean ghost. And I think that's what the mistake of a lot of people make, especially those who are a little overzealous about TV shows. I'm not knocking TV shows. I'm just saying. You know, if something goes bump or there isn't a ready explanation, they automatically jump to ghost. We don't know.
No.
You know, we had a recent case. Now, we can't show this. Well, one of the reasons we can't show the footage is because the DVR stopped recording, which in of itself might not sound, you know, could sound like user error. But then you add, my camera malfunctioned. Even after putting a whole set of new batteries, it still didn't work. It finally, on the third set of batteries, I finally got the control shots that I wanted. Then we brought up the other camera, the camcorder. Went through two batteries on that, which, I mean, I know, I saw you charge that battery. I know that battery was fully charged.
Yep.
And 5 minutes into recording,
taken by themselves, you would think that it's nothing, but it was a sequence of events and the circumstances surrounding them that made us go,
So going back to the footage that we can't show because the DVR, you know, went kaput, the camera moved. And it moved about 15 degrees to the right. And at first, I was the first one to dismiss it. I just said, well, the investigators are too close to it. We have to throw it out. And then we saw them do what we thought were dancing and doing contortions, but they were really trying to debunk the camera moving. And they were tugging on cords, hitting the table. They were doing everything to make that thing move again. And then you and I went up there, and we did the same thing. We tugged on the carpeting. We did everything possible to make that camera move. We couldn't make it move again. The only way we moved it was we physically took our hand and
put
turned
it. The lens and turned it. Yep.
And again, you know, enough stuff happens where you gotta throw your hands up and say, you know, we don't have all the answers yet, because I don't have an answer for that.
Yeah, I don't have an answer for that myself. It was odd. It was very odd. It's just one of those things that make it go, you know.
And there are other circumstances surrounding that particular thing that makes us go, I don't know, because it was aimed at a particular
room.
And on a previous investigation, one of our investigators thought he saw something in that room.
Yeah, you'll talk about that on a separate episode.
So that's why when people are like, oh, big deal, camera moved, well, maybe, maybe not.
Again, taken by itself, you wouldn't think nothing of it, but you add it up together with the previous investigation, this investigation, the events surrounding both occurrences.
Yeah. The claims.
The claims. That's it. Yeah. It just makes you wonder.
So adding it up and you know, and we had much stricter controls this time. We had cameras all over the place to make sure people were where they said they were going to be. I don't know. I don't have any. I can't answer that right now.
No.
Am I saying it's a ghost? I'm not saying it's a ghost. I'm just saying something weird happened that we can't explain right now.
Could have been Tinkerbell for all we know.
Don't be making fun of Tinkerbell.
I like Tinkerbell.
I like
Tinkerbell. She's my favorite fairy.
She's awesome.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Needs a new outfit, but you know, I'm just saying.
Green is her color.
Yeah. I think she'd look good in blue.
Okay. Anyway. Well, we'll contact the people at Disney for
okay.
you.
Okay. We should.
But going back to parapsychology and what we do in paranormal research, the reason I brought this up today, and we've talked about it before, is because there, if you go on a lot of sites, there's a lot of bashing, there's a lot of conclusions, there is no education or certification, and I will agree there may not be accredited certification, there may not be accredited education, but there are courses to this day that are being taught that are relevant to parapsychology at accredited universities. So I think people have to be careful before they call people liars and that.
Yeah, you know. Exactly. Get all your facts straight first. Do your homework, then draw your conclusion.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we got a couple of questions sent in by our listeners, and we'll answer them then. So stay tuned.
Around the water cooler at your paranormal team's head office is all about mypara.net.
Mypara.net has everything paranormal enthusiasts desire.
Events, blogs, videos, celebs, radio. Spice up your profile with the wonderful customization features that MyPara.net has that other social networking sites do not.
Point your Firefox browser to www.mypara.net.
Do it now. Do it today.
There's no charge to be a member at MyPara.net.
It is 100% free.
Are you looking to network with thousands of other paranormal enthusiasts?
Or anything ghosts and hauntings, UFOs, cryptozoology, and anything mysterious and unexplained.
You need to tell a friend today and log on to www.mypara.net.
MyPara is the paranormal social network.
Hey, welcome back. We're going into our Q&A segment. Again, if you have any questions that you want to send us about the show or about any topic about the paranormal, send them in to us at contact@thegsny.com. You can visit our website, www.thegsny.com, and there's links both for Carolyn and I there. If you want to send us questions directly, there's our general link, which is the contact one. Also, there's links to our Facebook page and our Twitter feeds, so you can check us out there, or you can listen to any of our past episodes through our link on our show. So, and also, there's links there for Carolyn's Creepy Corner, where you can read a lot of great articles. Carolyn's done a ton of research on these. So, why don't you take our first question?
Okay, this comes from our favorite person, No Name.
Ah, No Name.
On a past show, I don't think this is a question. On a past show, you guys said there is no certification in paranormal investigating, but I see people who are parapsychologists on TV all the time, so you must have been wrong. Well, yes and no. Again, as we mentioned in the show, the term parapsychology has been adopted by a wider base of people. Right. In my opinion, some of them do not qualify as true parapsychologists. But at the same time, there are true parapsychologists, some that are awarded degrees currently in the UK, and some of them who were in the United States. Now remember, the United States did have parapsychology degrees clear up until the 1980s. So that's why. As far as current certification, accredited state board of education approved degrees, as far as I know, as far as I could find right now, currently there is no such thing in the United States.
Right.
So
hopefully that answers your question. Thanks for sending in, by the way. Next question we have is from Jeffrey. Where can I go to school to become a professional paranormal investigator? Nowhere that I know.
Yeah, technically you can't. I mean, there's no such thing.
You can go to UK, I guess. I don't
know. Well, and again, that would be more of a parapsychologist.
Right.
As far as a professional paranormal investigator, if you're thinking you can make money off of this, no, not so much.
Or if you do, please let us know.
Well, again, true parapsychologists that do have a legitimate degree, they make their money through funding through whichever institution that they work for.
Grants,
they
don't, that sort of thing.
Yeah, they don't charge their clients. So if you're thinking about going in and charging people, then no, that's not what you do. As far as going to school, I'm all for education. There are accredited universities that do courses that are related to parapsychology, but they are not parapsychology degrees, unless you go to the UK. So at this point, Jeffrey, there is really no place in the United States to go to, quote, become a professional paranormal investigator.
Yeah, I mean, if you leave out the professional paranormal investigator and you want, like, a degree or something to help you as an investigator later on, you could take any of those courses that we were naming there for our dream team. You know, look up psychology, anatomy, physiology, meteorology, geology, physics.
Anthropology.
Electronics, you know, IT field, photography, videography, audio engineering, you know, stuff like this. Or even the construction field, so you can know about structural engineering and how things work and stuff like that.
So hopefully that answered your question.
Let's take our next one.
This comes from Kate.
Yep.
Have you ever witnessed an object move on its own or fly? I've seen a bird fly. Okay.
I don't think that's what you meant.
No. Yes. Short answer is yes, I have.
Yeah, short answer for me is yes, also I have. What made it do it, I have no idea. And at the time, I'll admit, I was startled because I was not expecting it. We were just talking about how we saw a camera in our DVR move on its own. Have no explanation whatsoever for that.
We tried to recreate it. We were unable to.
We were unable to. I've been on cases to where things have flown off mantelpieces. You had an experience at a previous employer where you had a shoe go flying.
Yeah, right in front of me. And I'm going to talk to that in more depth in another show. But yes, I saw a shoe, and I'm not saying a shoe fell. I mean a shoe launched itself off a shelf. And what kind of added to the credibility of that is that later on a different shoe from a different shelf was caught on camera, one of the security cameras, when nobody was in the building. So
I've seen a lot of things move on their own. Again, I have no explanation on what it could be.
It's a ghost. I'm not saying what it is. I'm saying it moved by itself.
It could be Fluffy the Bunny that was invisible happened to move that object. I have no idea.
I was a volunteer for a historical museum that it was a house turned into a museum, and a lot of the original furniture was still in there and artifacts from the family. We did not see things move, but you would leave the room and come back, and things were not where they had just been. And when you know you're the only people in there and you have security motion sensors to confirm you're the only people in there, it's a little weird, you know?
Yeah. So, it could be anything from PK to who knows. But so hopefully that answers your question, Kate.
Really sneaky mice.
Could be.
I don't know.
Could be. If you want a follow-up question with that or anything, send it in to us. We'll be glad to answer that for you. Next question comes from John. In your opinion, what do you think causes cold spots?
Ice.
Yeah. I don't think that's what he means.
Oh.
We've mentioned this on previous episodes. It could be a change in humidity.
Mm-hmm.
The dew point will give you that cold spot sensation with it not necessarily being a cold spot. You could have drafts coming in from a source you wouldn't think, and that will cause a cold spot also.
Just the temperature variance between the outside and the inside of a structure can create certain currents and drafts that if you're just standing there and a draft goes by, it can feel cold and like a cold spot, like you said. Also, to take into account the effects of EMF fields, whether they're high EMF fields or not, certain EMF fields can induce what they call experience-inducing fields, and they create what's called tactile hallucinations. And one of the most commonly reported tactile hallucination is that tingly spider web tingling feeling. Right. And also, people have reported it feels like a cold, that electrical kind of cold.
That prickly cold feeling.
Yeah. So that is a common tactile hallucination. So it's something to take into consideration before you conclude that there's a ghost tapping you on the shoulder.
Yeah. I mean, one of the best tools to have in that case is like a millimeter with a built-in ambient thermometer.
Right.
If you're trying to find an actual cold spot. And maybe you can trace it back at that
point. And
make
sure it is an ambient thermometer and not a surface thermometer.
Yeah, surface thermometers aren't going to help you one bit.
Yeah.
So hopefully that answers your question, John. Again, if any listeners out there have any questions for us or comments on the show, feel free to send them in to contact@thegsny.com. We'll be glad to answer those questions for you. Send us a question via our Facebook even. You can do that. And we'll be glad to have a discussion with you. So that wraps it up for another episode here on the GS Podcast. Hopefully you'll tune in with us next week, and we'll have some more good information for you.